Radio Free Press, a podcast from the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom, campaigning for free, independent and accountable media.
The last decade has seen savage retrenchment in the news media, the decimation of our once proud and prosperous local press, the loss of much-loved regional television programmes, a dramatic fall in the sales of national daily and Sunday newspapers, and a seemingly endless process of salami slicing in the output of national broadcasters like the BBC and ITV. Thousands of reporters, photographers, radio and television broadcasts and producers have lost their jobs. Of course, workers in all sorts of industries and services have faced a similar level of closures and redundancies. And to their great regret, many of those employees have lost a distinctive trade union voice to represent their interests. But that's not been so for journalists. We still have the National Union of Journalists, a strong and independent voice in the shifting sands of the modern media marketplace of today. Steering his way through the unprecedented turbulence of the last decade has been the Journalist General Secretary, Jeremy Deer, who was first elected in 2001 and who stands down in July 2011 after 10 pretty momentous years at the helm of the National Union of Journalists. Jeremy Deer, as General Secretary, in your final weeks in office, let's begin with your assessment of the decade that you led your union.
I think that was a pretty fair introduction in terms of the assessment of what has happened to news media.
Was it as bleak as that?
I think in some cases it's bleaker than that. But in many cases, I think there are exciting opportunities for journalism as well as a result of changes in technology. But I mean, let's not forget, over the past 2 or 3 years, we've seen the loss of more than a quarter of jobs in local newspapers. We've seen more than 1,000 jobs go at ITV and the halving of ITV's regional services. We've seen thousands of jobs go at the BBC. And there is no way that anybody can argue that the news media is better as a result of having lost all those journalists, whether they're reporters, subs, designers, producers, programme makers. So journalism has suffered, certainly over the last decade or so.
What has surprised you most of all? Has it been the pace of the shift from print to reading online, for example, and the impact that that's had?
I mean, that certainly had an impact, but I mean, from my own point of view, the biggest impact has been the change in the nature of the organisation of news media. News has increasingly become a commodity. I've seen it since I first became a journalist. I've seen it, but I've seen it in the last decade as well. We now have these huge, multinational, in many cases, corporations running local news media and running them solely to make a profit. And you either make a profit by selling more or you make a profit by cutting costs, and they have resorted largely to cutting costs as a way of achieving their profits. I mean, lots of people blame the internet, lots of people blame the recession. Of course they are factors in the changing way in which people consume news, but the simple fact is, it is the economic organisation of the news industry which has been the single biggest factor in all of that.
Now, you said that you thought there'd been this change, this dramatic change within the industry. Thousands of jobs might have been lost, but haven't thousands of jobs been created in new industries which are in the field of communication, which might be open to the National Union of Journalists?
Clearly there are, and for us, the biggest growth sector of the last 3 or 4 years is what we kind of term new media, although some of the media in which those people are working in might not be considered to be new now. But of course there are a lot more online journalists, there are a lot more internet publications, online only publications, there are a lot more kind of SMS news services, there are a lot more blogs and podcasts and so on, which journalists are producing. But the reality is there are fewer journalists doing fewer stories, covering a narrower range of stories in journalism today than there was a decade ago. And that's bad for journalism, and of course is bad for the National Union of Journalists.
But it does pose the question, doesn't it? Does and can you look back on the NUJ's period and say, look, we did enough to keep up with that pace of change? Because that, of course, would be the charge that would be put to you during your decade in power.
I don't think we can say we did enough. Unions are conservative with a small c in their nature. Their job is to protect the terms and conditions of their members. And we had a period of time, I would have said 2 or 3 years, where we had a real battle internally between the interests of defending what some people saw as old and traditional media, whilst we had lots of young new members advocating that we should make a dramatic turn to new media. We did neither of the two. We married those two parts together, and I think successfully steered our way through what has been the most enormous technological change we've ever seen in the industry. And you can imagine in the past, the NUJ would have been in absolute crisis over something like this. We've steered our way through with the odd criticism from either traditionalists or new media people, but on the whole, we've managed to maintain our density of union membership throughout it all. We've maintained our financial stability, and we have, I believe today, a louder voice for journalists and journalism than we had a decade ago.
So if the charge was put to the NUJ that it's been too dominated by print, that it's a membership with the wrong age profile and hasn't done enough to attract younger members, how would you answer that charge?
Well, I mean, I would absolutely reject that charge. I think you can always level charges, say you could have done this little bit better, that little bit better. But we have one of the youngest age profiles of any union in the TUC. We have a membership that grew significantly, of course has declined with the decline in the number of jobs, but has declined by around 6%, whilst we've seen around 20% fall in the number of jobs in our traditional areas. Now, that says to me we've made quite a successful transition to recruiting and winning people in new areas of media, in particular a lot of the new broadcasters that came online, in particular a lot of online publications, and I think we are still moving towards reaching out to whole new areas. Indeed, it's one of the biggest debates in the union at the moment is, how do we define what a journalist is today, and what is journalistic work in a new media age? And we're always going to be debating that and stretching the boundaries of who the union recruits. But I think we've been pretty successful at that, although I would never be one to sit here and say we couldn't have been more successful or done it better.
Now, another part of the transition of the union during your leadership has been the fact that it has become more political. It has adopted a higher political profile. Now, if I put it to you that that might perhaps have been one reason why perhaps the union hasn't attracted as many members as it might, how would you respond to that criticism?
Well, I mean, I don't think that's a criticism that stands up to any scrutiny. At the time I was elected, we established, and one of the first things I did was to establish a parliamentary group, cross-party parliamentary group. It has people from 5 different political parties represented in it, in order to try to raise the profile of issues that were important to journalists in the political arena, because a lot of the work that journalists do is governed by regulation, or if it's at the BBC, it's governed by the charter and the licence fee settlement and all those kind of issues. And we wanted to make sure that we had a voice there. That's the sole purpose of it. It's not to deliver support for any particular party or any particular politics. It is for advocating the views of NUJ members in all the arenas in which it's important that those views are heard. And of course, I mean, my fundamental belief is that politics is important to economics and social justice and all the other things that matter to the union and its members. And therefore, I think it's right that we have a political voice, but an independent political voice, independent of all parties and interests and so on. And the thing about our parliamentary group compared to a lot of others, we don't pay any MPs to be members of it. We don't give money to anybody. We simply say, here is an interest group around the issues of journalists and journalism. If you want to be part of that and help us advocate these issues, then you can be part of the group. And so it is very much on our terms, not on the politicians' terms, that we do that.
Mm. But when you push the boat out, though, and try to get approval for a political fund so that the union could increase its political activity even further. That led to quite a lot of criticism. I'm a broadcaster. I know what it was like in the BBC. There was criticism. There was a concern that the NUJ was becoming too political.
Yeah. No, no, and I accept that that is a valid criticism. I was never an advocate of a political fund, which is what the vote was about, partly because I already believe that the union did the work that was necessary in order to advocate for its members in a political arena. It didn't need a political fund to say, well, we don't like the way the Press Complaints Commission operates, or we don't like the fact that that a government, any government, might take away our rights at work or deny us the right to strike or whatever it might be. We didn't need a political fund, I didn't believe, to do that. We've done that since the founding day of the NUJ, and we'll always continue to make that case. So, I mean, I think it was a divisive episode in the NUJ. One of the few, to be honest, that I've had to contend with. If you look back at the history, I've not had so many of those divisive episodes. But it was, clearly, there was very public criticism. People like John Snow gave it as a reason for no longer wanting to be part of the union if we voted for a political fund. I think that was a strong argument, but that's why members voted against it. That's the democracy of the NUJ. We were asked by our conference to have a vote on it. We had a vote on it. It was rejected. It's never been resurrected, and that's democracy, and we live with the results of it.
Of course, another factor is that we have in Britain a politicised press, whether we like it or not. We have national newspapers which are owned by proprietors who like to pursue a political agenda. And of course that makes it difficult, doesn't it, for a union like the National Union of Journalists, because it can lead, can't it, to certain groups of journalists feeling ostracised, feeling unwelcome, especially, for example, the journalists of the Rupert Murdoch Press.
It can, but equally there are hundreds of members of the NUJ who work for Rupert Murdoch's newspapers and TV interests. The fact that we don't have union recognition there is a result of a deal done between Tony Blair and Rupert Murdoch that allowed him to set up a yellow union within the workplace, which he pays for, gives offices to, pays for its general secretary and its legal representation, but is able to legally stop us gaining recognition there. But take another place, the Telegraph, for example. You might say they would feel politically ostracised by a so-called left-wing union. Well, I was the union official in charge of recognition at the time. We went there, we organised, we had two union reps, one who was a former member of the Socialist Workers' Party, one who was a member of the Conservative Party, joint union representatives there. They organised the workforce, they had representatives in every part of the building, and we won a vote there on recognition by something like 96% was the yes vote. We were able to demonstrate to people, no matter what their view was, that the union acting collectively could give them a voice in the workplace, which could mean improved pay, improved terms and conditions, but also a voice about professional and ethical issues as well. So, and I mean, there's a great story there that the representative was called in and by Jeremy Deeds, and he said to him, look, surely people here don't want to belong to an organisation where everybody's called Ron, do they? And he was able to turn around and say, well, actually our general secretary is called Jeremy. it was the middle class name served me well for once.
nice one. But of course, you just there talked of a vote of over 90% in the Telegraph. What do you think it would be if you held a vote at News International among those members? For example, at Sky, Sky News, Rupert Murdoch's satellite channel, where I know the journalists are quite worried about revealing their union membership.
Yeah, I mean, if we were given the opportunity to have a fair vote where both sides got to put their case fairly without pressure being exerted on either side, we'd win an overwhelming mandate. But here we are dealing with one of the most ruthless and calculating businessmen that there's ever been, with enormous power, who is absolutely determined to keep unions out of his workplaces. So it wouldn't be, were you to say, well, there's going to be a ballot today, it wouldn't be a fair fair ballot. Even when we began organising before the union recognition legislation came in, they were delivering videos and cassette tapes to people's houses explaining the perils of trade unions and how it would probably mean them having to close down all their newspapers and everyone losing their jobs and so on and so forth. Complete propaganda, and yet that's the way Murdoch operates. So in a free and fair vote, I do not believe the union has lost a single recognition vote where we've been able to both sides sit and put the case fairly. We've lost two, one where on the eve of the ballot they dismissed the union representatives and basically sent out a chilling warning to say this is what will happen, and one in a very small publication that was on the verge of financial collapse, and that was used as a reason why people shouldn't vote for recognition, and we lost it by a single vote. So, I mean, where there is the opportunity for people to consider, I mean, who wouldn't vote for a situation where in unionised workplaces pay, average hourly pay is 15.3% higher, where on average there are 3 days more holiday, where there are less redundancies, and if there are redundancies, they're more likely to be voluntary rather than compulsory, and the terms you get are much better. Add to that things around health and safety and having a voice at work and dignity at work and all those. Why wouldn't you vote for that, no matter what your politics are?
Well, in a word, do you think you are going to get recognition ever at the Murdoch Press, at Sky News, at the new at the television stations, etc., which Murdoch owns?
Well, the problem for us is it would require a change in the law that would allow us to be able to apply for a recognition ballot because they have this News International Staff Association which operates inside. It doesn't actually have any members, you don't pay for membership, but it has a voluntary recognition agreement with News International, and therefore it stops us being able under law to put in an application for union recognition. So yes, I absolutely believe one day we will represent all the journalists working across the Murdoch Empire, but I need a change of government and a change of law, so I'm not expecting it to happen in the next few weeks before I go.
Now, we've looked at the role of the NUJ when it comes, as you say, to adjusting to the change in the makeup of the media. What about journalistic standards? Now, have you been surprised, for example, at the revelations about the extent of the way in which journalists have been breaking the law and tapping into the messages, for example, left on mobile telephones?
Have I been surprised by it?
Yeah.
In truth, probably not. I think we are well aware that where journalists are put under constant pressure from senior executives in order to deliver scoops that win market share and more readers and more advertisers as a result, that it is inevitable that journalists feeling under that pressure will compromise their ethical standards at times. And so I'm not surprised by it. I'm outraged that this should be allowed to happen. But we have argued long and hard that journalists should have a conscience clause, should be able to have a conscience clause in their contracts that would allow them to refuse assignments where they are asked to breach what are recognised industry codes. We would obviously say the NUJ's code of conduct, but it may even be the press complaints code, which are quite clearly being breached in these circumstances. You look at the economic pressure there is on journalists and newspapers to stretch the truth. You take the Express as a classic example of this, where Richard Desmond boasts that when he has front page sensationalist stories like the 1.6 million Roma to invade Britain, even though there are only 1.6 million Roma in the entire world, not all of them were coming to Britain. We all knew that was a complete lie, and yet he says, well, 30,000 extra sales on days when we have headlines like that. That to him justifies a headline like that. It justifies stretching or breaking the truth and in order to secure commercial advantage. And I think that's where the real fall in standards has come from, that you have, well, you have two things operating together. You have the cutting costs, which mean there are less journalists, which means a much greater reliance on corporate and celebrity PR, and therefore you have more kind of celebrity news rather than what we would term kind of hard news. And then you have this pressure to deliver these great scoops by any means necessary, and journalists fearing for their jobs are prepared sometimes to stretch those limits. It doesn't justify it, but it gives an explanation as to why it happens. And what I'd like to see is less journalists going to jail and more of the senior executives who are putting pressure on being called to account for these kind of things.
Now, in your answer, you didn't mention, of course, the Murdoch Press, because, of course, it's one of their journalists who has been to prison. Three of the journalists on the News of the World have now been suspended. But, of course, you're probably right not to single out News International, because other newspaper groups have been involved, haven't they? That's what the Information Commissioner showed, that there was widespread action by journalists using illegal sources to get information. Point to the NUJ. Has the NUJ turned a blind eye to this?
I don't believe we have turned a blind eye to it. When the Information Commissioner released that report, we called at that time for tougher penalties for those who are, if you like, the people who instigate this kind of activity, not necessarily the journalist that carries it out, but those under whose watch these things are knowingly carried out. And let's be clear, they are knowingly carried out. There isn't any way in which the amounts of money involved and the amounts of activity by individual journalists that the Information Commissioner seems to think that there is being done without senior editors and executives knowing about it. It's now about finding the paper trail in order to make sure that those people are held accountable for that. But no, I deliberately didn't mention News International alone, much as it's kind of fashionable and sometimes enjoyable to bash Murdoch, and he deserves an awful lot of what he gets. It is true that they are not the only ones involved in these kind of activities. But an important point for the union to make as well is that it's not raking through somebody's dustbin or phone hacking or deception by pretending to be somebody else in and of itself that is the issue. It is the reason it is done. If there is an overwhelming public interest in a journalist using subterfuge or means outside of those that we would normally use in order to secure information for a story that is overwhelmingly in the public interest, we would defend their right to do that. And I think that's kind of an important distinction. What we've got now is stuff that the public is interested in, not things that are in the public interest, and they are two very different things.
Deep down, as you know, certainly this has always been my belief, that if the information is correct, the means justify the ends. That seems to be the unwritten journalistic code. Do you find difficulty? You sound, Jeremy dear, as though you're comfortable with the fact that if push comes to shove, probably most journalists would take a risk, would take a punt on getting the information.
When push comes to shove, it kind of depends who's doing the pushing, doesn't it, to some extent? Because if it is, I mean, I would draw the line myself, and it's a personal view at information that I felt what it was justified me using any means to secure, and that to me means it has to be in citizens, in the public interest, in order to justify it. I don't believe that a lot of what has gone on, the kind of fishing trips that have gone on, listening into people's messages, are about securing information that is overwhelmingly in the public interest.
When it comes to looking at what's going to be done about telephone tapping, about the question of standards for newspapers, for journalists, the whole question of what's going to be done about the social media, the only show in town at the moment seems to be the Press Complaints Commission. It's quite clear that during your decade, the Labour government invested its faith in the Press Complaints Commission. It's quite clear now, under David Cameron, that the Coalition and certainly the Conservatives are investing their faith in beefing up the Press Complaints Commission. How does the NUJ stand with that?
I mean, I think we have, at different times in our history, kind of jumped backwards and forwards between reform of whatever the existing press regulatory body was, whether it was the Press Council or the Press Complaints Commission, and then calling for its total abolition and something new. I mean, for the past few years, we have very much been on the it needs reforming, it has to be democratized to some extent, so less of the great and the good sitting and more working frontline journalists involved in it. It has to have the power to be able to find those who are persistent offenders. It has to have more teeth. It has to have more independent finance, so it's not reliant on the owners of the media, and quite a lot of ways in which we thought it should be reformed. I think probably a number of issues recently, but the phone hacking scandal, I think, has probably been the final nail in its coffin for an awful lot of people who want to see a much more robust system of self-regulation. And we do believe in self-regulation. We're not asking politicians set up some statutory kind of body. We do believe in self-regulation, but it has to be self-regulation that serves the interests of the public and citizens, and has to have the power to bring repeat offenders to act in accordance with the codes. And too many of them make a judgment that if there is an economic interest in running a particular story, it may be better to do that and suffer the consequences of the PCC saying, well, that was very naughty, but not actually suffering. I really do fundamentally believe you have to hit them where it hurts if you are to bring about any serious change in the way the media operates.
But of course, this also raises the question as to why the NUJ isn't inside the Press Complaints Commission fighting its corner. Why is it, for example, that the one trade unionist on the PCC doesn't even come from the Journalist Trade Union, comes from the Communication Workers Union? Why has the NUJ turned its back on actually participating in the Press Complaints Commission as it is established at the moment?
I mean, I think this is a historical mistake that the NUJ made when it turned its back on the Press Council and then the Press Complaints Commission at the setting up of that. That wasn't my decision, and it was a democratic decision of the union. I'm not questioning making that decision. I think looking back, it is probably a mistake, because I would always far rather be in there fighting and, if necessary, exposing the failures from the inside than shouting from the outside. And one of the things I've tried to do is not just get as a voice on committees where this is being discussed in Parliament, so we get to go and give evidence, and we have nearly every time these issues have come up and made our point very strongly, including just over the past few weeks, but equally to make sure that we are regularly meeting with people from the Press Complaints Commission in order to make our case. So there is an engagement. They don't want us inside, let's be clear about that. Once we stepped out of it, we gave them the opportunity to keep us out probably forever, until it's completely reformed or reconstituted as a different organisation. But I do think, looking back, that's something that people might have made a different decision with the benefit of hindsight.
Now, we've just been discussing the question then of how to raise journalistic standards and the role of the Press Complaints Commission. What are the whole question of media ownership and the way that's been administered in this country, and especially during your 10 years as General Secretary?
Since the 70s, there has been a major kind of concentration of media ownership, but it has accelerated over the past decade or so, and successive governments have adopted a deregulatory approach, a loosening of the media ownership laws to such an extent that you now have in local newspapers, you have huge regional monopolies. In national media, you have a very small number of very wealthy individuals controlling the vast majority of our national media, whether it's newspapers, whether it's radio, or whether it's TV. And increasingly so with major online players as well. The very same owners are buying up everything. So that has a very significant impact on, of course, plurality and diversity. But also, the argument they used was by being able to share costs across a wider number of publications or media organisations, that they were able to put more money, therefore, into frontline journalism. Well, it hasn't happened. What they've done is put more money into the pockets of corporations and shareholders, and there is less money going into journalism. So you now have towns that have no local radio station, no local newspaper, and are not covered on regional news because the nearest reporter is 100 miles away on his own, based in an office somewhere else. And you actually now have a huge democratic deficit as a result of this concentration of media ownership, both on a national level, but very particularly in local media as well now.
We have to move on and look at what's going to happen in the future, which is cross-media ownership. Are you saying, I mean, you've talked about the dearth of local newspapers, local radio stations, local television. Of course, the alternative argument is that if there was no regulation preventing cross-media ownership that would allow, for example, for the same owner to have the television station, the local paper and the radio station, they then say that they could make money.
Well, they may say that hasn't really been the evidence of any countries or areas where that is the case. And I mean, I actually don't have a problem with changes happening in cross-media ownership. It is simply recognising there are technological changes. I do have a problem with them allowing greater concentration of media ownership across the whole of the media. So I wouldn't necessarily have a problem if a company wanted to own several things in one particular area. But if they have a huge regional monopoly and they thereby are able to keep other players out of the market, then there is a real problem with that. And I think one of the things that we've advocated much more recently is public support for local journalism, for all journalism, but in particular for local journalism. And it's a hard argument for journalists to kind of accept, with the exception of the BBC, which has a very distinct way. But I always go back to something that I think it was John Nicol wrote in The Nation about the founders of the free press never thought the freedom of the press would only belong to those who own the press, and they'd have been horrified at the idea that if rich people think there isn't enough commercial value in news, that a community should be deprived of that news. And he used that very much as an argument to talk about ways in which we help all kinds of businesses by tax breaks, by helping them with buildings or training grants or technology grants and things like this. But when it comes to the media, we all say, oh, we can't possibly have any public help because we're so independent. Well, actually, I think as long as there are barriers in place, I think there are strong arguments for public support for media in the public interest, certainly on a local level. And we did stuff around an economic stimulus plan for journalism at the time they were talking economic stimulus plans for banks and everything else, because we wanted to try to raise that whole debate about whether or not there are other ways to support journalism. Does it have to just be about making a profit, or can it be about making sure that there is access for citizens to quality news and information? And we think that's much more important than the right of Trinity Mirror to pay their shareholders a higher dividend each year.
Some stirring words there from you, Jeremy Dear, on the future of ways of perhaps encouraging a local media. You, of course, are leaving. My final question, you're leaving your bequest, if I could put it like that, to your successor, Michelle Stanistreet. You're leaving a union which, as you say, can punch above its weight, which has a strong membership and an independent voice. Looking ahead to Michelle Stanistreet's targets for the future. Where do you think the NUJ should be going in the next, say, in the next 4 to 5 years?
Well, I'm very lucky to have had a predecessor who said, if you ever want any advice from me, ring me. Otherwise, I'll shut up and let you get on with the job. And so I'm not going to say anything I think she should do. But in terms of things in the industry and things the union is going to have to face, I mean, I think there are kind of, first of all, there is the urgent issue of a new Communications Act. And it is an opportunity for all of us to raise the debate about the kind of media we want to see. We already see from Jeremy Hunt's very first communications on it that he's looking to how do you remove the burdens on business. It's yet again facing in a deregulatory era. We need to mobilise a coalition of people, not only journalists and not only the NUJ, but all those organisations, all those community groups who believe in a different kind of media, in order to begin to start that debate about what we want to see in the Communications Act. So, I mean, that's one huge issue for us. For the union, I would say that the big issue is how do we reach these new layers of people who are coming into journalism. There will always be journalism, there will always be people practicing it. We have to work out how the union can more successfully target those people. But there are also, I mean, big questions the union will have to think about in terms of sharing resources with other unions. All unions are having to face this question at the moment. But I mean, I have an enormous kind of faith in people's ability to change their world for the better, whether it's their own workplace or whether it's wider than that. And I mean, I leave kind of working full time for the NUJ. I'm not leaving the NUJ. I'll be a member, and I'm going back to be a journalist as well as doing some travelling. So I leave with an enormous faith in people's ability to change their environment, and I have every faith that under Michelle that the union will grow even stronger and that she'll build on all those things we've done over the last 10 years.
Thank you, Jeremy Dear. This podcast was produced by the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom by Claire Colley. A new book that raises and discusses some of these issues, The Lost Tribe of Fleet Street. Whatever happened to Fleet Street's industrial correspondence? It's a new book that can be purchased from the CPBF's website.